Exodus 16. I don't know whether Larry did this at the second setting of breakfast. I know he did it at the first setting. And I mean, in one sense, in two words, took away the whole presentation this morning. So it's really embarrassing, you know, to have that happen. But his word at the first setting, he said, when the Israelites left Egypt, they didn't leave Egypt behind. That's a good kind of rubric to put over this study for this morning. It's very germane to the material I want to deal with. Exodus chapter 16. Pharaoh, my kids keep running around, and the saying now is, it's history. You know, in other words, it's over, gone, past. Pharaoh is now gone. He's behind. Between Pharaoh, the oppressor, and the Israelites, the oppressed, now sits the Yam Suf. Contrary to any English translations that I've come across, the Red Sea appears nowhere in the biblical story. The phrase that has been regularly translated in English Bibles as the Red Sea, the Hebrew phrase is Yam Suf, and Yam Suf means literally a sea of reeds, probably refers to some kind of marshy terrain. You might do a better job if you're into images of watching Pharaoh and his chariots get caught in quicksand or something like that, or quick mud, as they chase the Israelites. But here's this little marsh that sits between Pharaoh and the Israelites, marking the boundary line between Egypt and the new place. And in this story, a whole month and a half have passed. 45 days, roughly, that the Israelites have been out of Egypt, have been living in their God-given freedom. What are they doing in their God-given freedom? Listen to verses 2 and 3 of chapter 16. And the whole congregation of the people of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness and said to them, "Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill the whole assembly with hunger." 45 days of freedom, and the Israelites are complaining about Moses and Aaron. Liberation is hard, because there's always a double liberation to be carried out. Not only the liberation from oppression, but the liberation from the mind that oppression creates. I recall for you what I said yesterday. Now, the real problem with slavery is that it works, that it creates slaves. Terrific visual image of that in my mind. Going back to the big TV series of Roots, I don't know whether you all saw that or not, but if you did, I recollect it for you. If you didn't, I recount it. This young African boy, Kunta Kinte, is taken by the slave traders from his African home, carried across the ocean to the United States, sold in the slave market, to a plantation owner. And the first thing that happens is that he's given another name by the plantation owner. He isn't Kunta Kinte anymore, he's Toby. But he resists this. He doesn't plug into that. He doesn't take the name, and he's perpetually trying to run away to escape. And finally, after one escape effort, they take him, they bring him back, they hoist him up, chain him up, and beat him, and beat him, and beat him, until what? Until he's willing to say, my name is Toby. What's in a name? In this instance, the slave identity. Now, the way the oppression works is to get the slave to acknowledge that they are slave, to build that mind in. Once that's integrated, the slave master has it made. Once that's integrated, the slave master can be away, and the slave is still slave. The mindset becomes the policing force for the slave. And that's not easy to get rid of. And so here at this point in the Exodus story, we have released slaves, but we don't have free people, because the Israelites still carry the slave mind with them. Now, it's absolutely necessary to have released slaves. That's a first step, and it's a necessary step, but it's a bad last step, because as long as the slave mind persists, whatever society those folks are going to create is going to be a society created by the slave mentality. The Exodus doesn't go from Egypt directly into the land of the promise. There's a journey period that takes place in between. Just because the slave mind has to be rooted out. Look at the nature of the complaint. Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate bread to the full. It's better to be a fat, well-kept slave than to be a free person with all of the risks that are attendant to that. That's the mindset. That's the mindset that's rooted in. See, these people in the Exodus story are liberated into a struggle. They're liberated into a wilderness. I really think that's something we don't take seriously enough. We assume that liberation means liberation from struggle. But in the biblical model, liberation is first of all liberation into a struggle. You might want to reflect on your baptism in that framework sometime. You don't go from deliverance into promised land, you go from deliverance into desert. Deliverance leads to journey. Now God responds to this complaining. And the response is in verses 4 and 5. Then the Lord said to Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven to you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my instruction or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily. God's response to the complaining is to provide daily bread. And the daily bread will be the occasion for faith. Keep those two things up. The provision of daily bread and daily bread as the occasion for faith. Faith is not a matter of religious opinions. Faith is simple, bald-faced, out-and-out trust. Will daily bread be received as daily bread? Will this journey, will this walk happen according to the instruction of God? These people had absolutely nothing to do with their release from bondage. Now remember that. There was no Pharaoh cooperation. We had a reluctant leader and organizer, and we had people whose spirits were so broken that they couldn't believe. God took that hard work upon himself, and now the people are free. But now they are free in order to trust God. Their freedom means trusting. And I did a little translation switch on you there, so I want to explain it. My RSV English Bible reads, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or not. And if you were following the text, you realize that when I got to the word law, I read instruction for you. The reason I did that is that the Hebrew word that sits behind that word law is the word Torah. And Torah really does not mean law in any sense that English folks use that word law. The word Torah is a noun that comes from a verb that means to teach or to instruct, not to make rules. And so Torah really properly means instruction or teaching. And in fact, if you think about it for a minute, our Hebrew brothers and sisters, our Jewish brothers and sisters, call the first five books of the Bible Torah. Now, there obviously is law and rules within those first five books, but you know as well as I do, the first five books is not simply a collection of law and rules. In fact, for the most part, it's a story, it's a narrative. And that narrative is understood as an instruction, a teaching. This particular teaching is precisely related to the way in which daily bread is given. Daily bread is given daily, and it's received and gathered and eaten daily. And that's what the test is all about. Do you take daily bread as daily bread, or do you want to do something else with it? Now in the next verses of chapter 16, Moses and Aaron deliver the message that has been given by God to the people. They deliver it in an expanded form and with a significant interpretation. The significant interpretation first. Verse 6. So Moses and Aaron said to the people, to all the people of Israel, at evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning you shall see the glory of God, because he has heard your murmurings against the Lord. For what are we that you murmur against us? Now you know as well as I do from just having heard the text that the people murmured against Aaron and Moses. But that now is interpreted to them as murmuring against God. I have to be honest, I'm not sure I would like to use that interpretation of complaints of my congregation. That's a little scary, that's a little risky business to do. But here, that's what Moses and Aaron do. They say, look, you may say your words against us, but the fact of the matter is that's insignificant. That complaint is against God. You know, our being here is not our business, it's God's business. And that's where your complaint is really lodged. So Second thing is the expansion. In verse 8, Moses says, when the Lord gives you in the evening flesh to eat, and in the morning bread to the full, because the Lord has heard your murmurings, which you murmur against him. Right? Notice the expansion there. Meat as well as bread is included in this story. Now, I register that item with you just so that you know it's there. I'm not going to do anything with it. And the reason I'm not going to do anything with it is because the text doesn't do anything with it. It also is only noted that there's meat involved. But the story comes to focus around the interpretation of daily bread. And so that's what we focus our attention on. Daily bread is, of course, the notorious or famous manna. You knew that before we read this story. So that's no news to you. Now, if you ask me, what is manna? I'm going to give you nothing more and nothing less than the Bible's own answer to that question. Okay. So if you say, well, what is manna? I say, well, let's look at verse 14. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as hoarfrost on the ground. And in verse 31, it was like coriander seed, white, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. Now that's the biblical description of manna. And if you say, yeah, okay, I know I can read that, but what is it? Okay, what is it really? Well, then the only thing I can say to that is something of this order. First of all, if you ask that question and say, I'm really confused about it, then I will say to you, so am I. I know nothing more about it than what's there. And secondly, we're in good company because the Israelites were also confused by this stuff, which is why they called it manna. Manna is, after all, only the Hebrew word for what is it? Huh? So, verse 15, when the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, manna, what is it? So the question is posed one more time to us. And now let's respond to the question in its biblical context. See, what is it? There are a variety of ways of answering that question, right? I mean, I could do it the way I just did with this description. Flake-like stuff, coriander seed, tastes like wafer. And you say, yeah, but what is it? And I could go on and I could say, well, let's do a chemical analysis. And we'll find some of this stuff and we'll break it down. And I give you the chemical components of it. And that would probably satisfy most of us, because if we could get that, we would be able to say, ah, okay, now I know what's going on. See, it's this particular substance, and there it's out in the desert, and here's what happens in the desert, and so on down the line. That answer isn't given in the Bible, but Moses gives another answer to the question in the Bible of what is it when that stuff is encountered, and he answers the question theologically. There's a theological answer to the question, what is it? The people said, what is it? And in verse 15, Moses said, it is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. That's what it really is. Chemical analysis, description, beside the point. What it is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. Try it at lunch today. Somebody comes up to you and says, hey, what's for lunch today? The bread which the Lord has given us to eat. It's a different way of looking at things. And there's a theological interpretation of it. Now, this manna has some very peculiar properties to it that we need to pay attention to, that are outlined in the text. First of all, it's gift. It is not earned. It is daily bread that is rained down by God from heaven. But in the marshaling of this daily bread as food, human labor participates. People go out and they gather it. There is no nourishment that sort of takes place by mystical absorption. The food is provided, and human labor marshals it and puts it together, gathers it, cooks it, eats it. Gift, but human labor participates. Secondly, it is gathered only in terms of enough. Listen to verses 17 and 18. Or let me go back to 16 first. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, every one of you, as much as they can eat. You shall take an omer apiece, according to the number of persons whom each of you has in his tent. And the people of Israel did so. They gathered, some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, the one who gathered much had nothing over, and the one who gathered little had no lack. Each gathered according to what he could eat. From each according to their ability, to each according to their need, did not originate with Karl Marx. It originated with the gift of daily bread in Exodus 16. It is always gathered in terms of enough. Third, manna cannot be kept overnight. It is daily bread and must be received daily. And if you try to store it overnight, some pretty nasty things happen, or at least undesirable things. Verses 19 and 20. And Moses said to them, let no one leave any of it till morning. And you gather it one day, it's consumed in that day. You don't keep it over. But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and became foul. When it's hoarded, it rots. Hoarded daily bread goes rotten. There's only one exception to that, a built-in exception. And that is special provision is made for a two-day supply in order to deal with the event of the Sabbath. Now, in the structure of the Exodus story, the commandment about the Sabbath hasn't even been given yet. But in this manna story, provision is made so that people will be able to observe the Sabbath. On day six of collection, you collect what is needed for 2 days, and quite paradoxically, in a sense, you can't go out on the seventh day and try to pick up something extra. It doesn't work that way. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers apiece, and then there's a commandment, instruction given on how you deal with it to preserve it overnight, because remember, normally overnight it goes bad. Peculiar thing happens. On the seventh day, this is verse 27, some of the people went out to gather, and they found none. It doesn't work. I mean, this thing works. This daily bread stuff works according to the way in which God offers the daily bread, or it doesn't work at all. That's what it boils down to. One other note. The keeping of a portion of this daily bread. The Israelites get a special instruction from God. They are to keep a portion of this daily bread on reserve in a special place, and they will carry it with them not only through the 40 years, but they'll keep it after they get into this habitable land. It's a strange thing. Israel will not spend its whole life in the wilderness. They will sooner or later come into a habitable land. And when they are in a habitable land, they will make bread and they will grow grain and grind it and mill it and leaven it and bake it and have bread just like everybody else has bread. And it will be very easy in that circumstance to understand bread as the product of human labor, as simply the product of human labor. And so they will keep a chunk of this manna, this daily bread, alongside as a constant reminder to them of where they've come from and how they got there and what they are really all about, so that hopefully their own bread can be understood as daily bread. But there will be a time when they will no longer eat manna. Okay, so here's the first step in this story, it seems to me, to the rooting out of this slave consciousness. Slaves see life as the product of their work. And interestingly enough, to go back earlier in Exodus, I don't know if you noticed this or not, but the only product of Israelite labor in the early Exodus stories, and we're told that it's hard, that it was burdensome and everything else, but if you say, what is it that they were building, the only description of it is storehouses. They were building storehouses, places to pack up and to store and to preserve stuff, to accumulate in. And that's the slave mentality. That's the exact mirror image of the oppressor's mentality, that life is about accumulation and storing things up. Free people see life in terms of daily bread. That's the first thing that has to happen to our consciousness to be free people, is that life is seen in terms of daily bread. It's kind of interesting. There's two footnotes to this story. One within the Israelite tradition, one within the New Testament tradition that ought to be borne out. Or held up. First of all, in Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 3, okay, the manna story is held up in this very peculiar fashion. The Lord humbled you and let you hunger and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, your ancestors know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but that man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. Manna, daily bread, has the task of teaching us that we live by the word of God, by what God says and does. Huh? Right. Manna, real solid food, has the task of teaching us that we live by the word of God. How appropriate Eucharist is.
Jesus in the wilderness. Okay, remember the story in the wilderness? Jesus in the wilderness is tempted by Satan in his hunger to turn bread, or to turn rocks into bread. And he responds with the citation of this verse from Deuteronomy. I hold that up because we have a tendency to really misinterpret that verse of Jesus. He says, it is written, right, that human beings do not live by bread alone, but by everything that proceeds by the mouth of, from the mouth of God. And we immediately say, aha, the contrast is between this kind of physical, spiritual, or this physical, bodily stuff, bread, and then spiritual life, Word of God. No such biblical distinction. What demonstrates that we live by the Word of God is the kind of food that we eat. Daily bread, rather than what we can muscle out of the earth. Numbers chapter 11. Similar story, different method of procedure. The pilgrimage continues. As the story is laid out, it's about 14 months past the Exodus event. And some things have happened in the meantime, one of which we just read. Daily bread has been a regular provision for this people on the journey. Not only that, they have been at Sinai, where they have been given the covenant by God, including the commandments, which we'll deal with tomorrow. There's a terrific Hebrew story about the visit to Sinai. There's a strange phrase in the Hebrew text. If you read it in the English text, it says, the people stood at the foot of the mountain. That's probably what it means. But literally, the Hebrew text says, they stood under the mountain. Okay, and that the ancient Jewish rabbis always marveled about these kinds of things. They said, what does it mean that people stood under the mountain? And what the ancient rabbi said was, what it means is, that the people, as always, didn't particularly want this covenant. They didn't agree to this covenant. Say, oh, God, gee, it's really nice to make covenant with us. Let's put it together. Wow, for us. You know, we're more than willing to be your people. So now, people were reluctant. So what God did was to pick the mountain up and hold it over their head. I made an offer they couldn't refuse. When we hear the word of the commandments tomorrow, you will be my people. Want to try the option? Sinai has intervened. The covenant has been made by God with the people. They've been fed all along the way. But the slave consciousness dies hard. It's not an easy process. And so the complaint goes up again. Verses 4 through 6 of Numbers 11. Now the rabble that was among them had a strong craving. This complaint initiates in this rabble. Had a strong craving, and the people of Israel also wept again and said, I'll tell you what they said in a minute, how come it's always the worst among us that determine the activity of the best? So, why didn't the rest of the people determine the shape of life for the rabble? How come it's the rabble that determines the shape of life for the rest of the people? I don't know. That's the question. But here's the complaint. Oh, that we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt for nothing. That's an odd twist, huh? Right? I mean, the master teaches us, look, I mean, I take care of my black folk. Right? You get to eat here for nothing. The cucumbers and the melons, the leeks and the onions and the garlic. But now our strength is dried up and there's nothing at all but this manna to look at. Earlier on in Exodus, the complaint was they had that no food at all. Now they got food, but just not good enough. Egypt really wasn't so bad. They'd have been willing at this point in the journey to trade their freedom for affluence. Don't jump on them too hard. What would you trade your freedom for? I have a sneaking suspicion that one of the real sicknesses of our society is that we'll trade other people's freedom for our affluence. Now, maybe these Jews weren't so bad after all. At least it was only their own freedom that they were willing to trade for affluence. But that's the slave mind, huh? Affluence beats freedom any day. Ever find yourself saying that? I'd give up my freedom to be rich. The complaint of the people gets to Moses. And what Moses does, to show you that Moses is not all clean at this point, right? Moses turns the complaint against God. Verses 10 and following. Moses heard the people weeping throughout their family, every man at the door of his tent, and the anger of the Lord blazed hotly, and Moses was displeased. Moses said to the Lord, "Why hast thou dealt ill with thy servant? And why have I not found favor in thy sight, that thou dost lay the burden of all this people upon me? Did I conceive this people? Did I bring them forth, that you should say to me, carry them in your bosom? The nurse carries a suckling child to the land which thou didst swear to give to their fathers. Where am I to get meat to give all this people? For they weep before me and say, give us meat that we may eat. I'm not able to bear the burden of this people alone. Too heavy for me." And whose idea was this liberation anyway? I was minding my own business keeping sheep in the desert. You're the guy who lit the fire on the mountain. I even told you they wouldn't listen. I even told you they wouldn't believe. And you're the guy that kept pushing me, and now we're out here, and now the complaint hits me. What kind of deal is that? I didn't even get a chance to, I tried to decline the candidacy several times. And so deep, is the despair of this leader that he even says, look, if this is what I've got to deal with, kill me now. If thou wilt deal thus with me, kill me at once, if I find favor in your sight. God, you keep telling me you like me. How come I got to deal with all of the trouble? It's not even my personal trouble. It's their trouble. Jeez, I'm not complaining. I'm not weeping. God responds to Moses bringing the complaint to him. The twofold response. First of all, from now on, Moses will get his wish. He will get to share the load. 70 elders out of the community will be given the same spirit as Moses to share the leadership, to share the burden of carrying this people along through the desert. That's the first part. The second part, one I want to concentrate on, is a direct response to the complaint that's made. Remember, the complaint about no food receives a direct response from God in daily bread. Gracious gift of life. Here, the direct response comes, but it's a response of judgment. I'm really glad that there's some kind of humor in the course of this judgment. Otherwise, it'd be pretty heavy. But listen to the way it goes from verse 18 on. God addresses Moses, and this is what he tells him to say to the people. Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, who will give us meat to eat? For it was well in Egypt. Okay, you want meat? I'll give you meat. Therefore the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. You shall not eat one day, or 2 days, or 5 days, or 10 days, or 20 days, but for a whole month until it comes out your nose and becomes loathsome to you because you've rejected the Lord who is among you and have wept before him saying, why did we come out from Egypt? Okay, see what happens. You want to be fat? And I have this image of God sitting on this collective chest and shoving this meat down the throat. Do you ever think of affluence as judgment? I mean, I know there was one other affluent guy in a biblical story who never thought about it as judgment, you know. He appears in a parable of Jesus up in Luke. This guy can really farm. I mean, he builds barns and he gets so much stuff, he tears them down. He builds bigger barns and collects all of that stuff in there. And then there's this very odd phrase that comes. At the very moment that he finally says, I got enough with all of these overflowing barns, a voice speaks and it says, you fool. Tonight, and this is literal Greek at that point, right? Tonight, they require your soul of you. That always gets translated into English as if God's going to knock this guy off. This is the point of the story. The point of the story is that everything that he's accumulated has taken his soul away from him. The affluence itself is the judgment. You can eat yourself sick, and every one of us know that on an individual basis. You can eat yourself sick. But here, that's not just individual, that's socially. You can eat yourself sick, and so bloat yourself as a people. And the bloating is the very judgment. You don't need an extra judgment on top of it, you know? That is the judgment. It's like your kid eats too much and gets sick, you know? You don't need to spank him on top of it, folks. Moses' response to this, by the way, is just absolutely, he's just incredulous. He can't believe it. You know, like, God, we got 600,000 people out here in the desert. You know, where are we going to get, that's more than a side of beef. More than a side of beef. We're going to have to kill a whole herd and all the flocks to do that, you know. Where are you going to get that stuff? And the answer that God gives them is simply watch. Just watch. That's all. Here's where it goes in the biblical text. Moses says, the people among whom I am number 600,000 on foot, and thou hast said, I will give them meat that they may eat a whole month. Shall flocks and herds be slaughtered to suffice them? Or shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them to suffice them? And the Lord said to Moses, is the Lord's hand shortened? Now you shall see whether my word will come true for you or not. Well, there's a little interlude in the story about some people. I'm going to pass over that and pick up this story again at verse 31. A wind blows some quail into the desert. And exhausted, they fall to the ground. That's a real nice pun, right? This is a windfall. Rather large proportions, huh? These fallen quail, according to the story, fall beside the camp about a day's journey on this side and a day's journey on the other side, round about the camp, and about 2 cubits above the face of the earth. Okay? Don't you think that's overdoing it? I don't know how far you can go in a day's journey, folks, you know, I mean, when you're wandering through the desert, but that's a lot of quail, no matter how you cut it. And the people really go to it. Right, verse 32, and the people rose all that day and all night and all the next day, and they gathered the quails and he who gathered least gathered 10 homers.
I very frankly didn't know what a homer was when I read that. It's obviously a unit of measure of some kind or another, but I figured you probably wouldn't know either, so I went and looked it up. And it seems that a homer is fundamentally the unit of burden that a donkey can carry. And the estimates on that are someplace between like 5 to 7 bushels. Okay. All right. Okay. Now, I mean, I understand these stories are stylized. I don't want to be too literal about this, but you get the point nonetheless. I mean, if the least anybody gathers is 10 bushels or 5 bushels of quail, or times 10, right? 10 times 5, 50 bushels of quail. That's a lot of meat. That's a lot of meat. And you can almost sense the kind of enthusiasm in the story. You know, God, finally, huh? Finally it's happening. We got it made now. Got all this stuff around. Well, not quite. Not quite. Verse 33, unfortunately, in our common mind, follows verse 32. While the meat was yet between their teeth, before it was consumed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people, and the Lord smote the people with a great plague. They ate themselves sick. Sounds kind of ruthless, don't you think? I mean, couldn't God have explained it a little bit? I mean, look, folks, you know, got a different kind of diet out here, and I'll come up with a little bit of roast fowl for you or something like that, but go it easy. Sounds ruthless, but the slave consciousness dies hard. It's hard to root it out. It's even harder to root it out than it was to get Pharaoh to let go. And it is, after all, the creation of free people that we're after. It's hard work to create free people. Story holds up, these two stories hold up two of the efforts of God to create free people. One, the gracious gift of manna, and the second one, the hard word of eating yourself sick. But both of those are going in the same direction. They both have the same intention. They're both there to root out the slave consciousness so that free people can be created. And after all, that's what the real need of the world is, to create free people, the kind of people who can rightly have dominion over the earth in the age of God. I probably don't have to say to you, don't flee the mercy of God. It's there to save you. But it's probably worth saying, don't flee from the judgment of God. It is also there to save us. It's for the sake of God's creation. Right. If you all didn't hear the question, say one more explanation about man shall not live by bread alone. What I'm observing is this. The fundamental story is this story of manna. What God provides is not some ideas and some thoughts about things, but he provides solid food. Strange food, to be sure, but solid food nonetheless. In the book of Deuteronomy, that story is picked up, and what is said there by the Deuteronomic author is that God provided this food, this manna, to show you that human beings do not live by bread alone, but by what proceeds from the mouth of God. But clearly manna is not words. What proceeds from the mouth of God in the as Deuteronomy picks up the story is the manna, the actual food. I think that's probably related to the whole business about God saying what he does and doing what he says. You know, interestingly enough, the word in Hebrew for God speaking is davar. Okay. And davar means, and is regularly translated, I mean, you couldn't pick them out in the Old Testament, so many, in English translation, it's regularly translated as either word or thing. Okay. It's not idle talk in any event. It's talk that materializes, if you will. And what I'm saying is that when Jesus picks up the temptation, picks up this verse in the temptation story in the wilderness, we ought not to overly spiritualize this, as if Jesus is saying somehow or another, you know, sure, hunger is to be tolerated. But the point is that hunger is to be dealt with under the word of God, not by human beings simply reaching into the lurch and somehow or another saying, okay, we'll expend all of our energy and we'll manufacture all this stuff and we'll take care of all this stuff and so on and so forth. I think in terms of a kind of popular understanding, a concept of daily bread probably would allow what the earth currently provides to feed the human population. I mean, there's hunger in the world, not because God and the earth are chintzy, but because we don't distribute very well. And no amount of talk can substitute for that real stuff.
The thing being pretty as hard you said, didn't you?
Yeah, at least twice.
Mixed meaning, it's uncharted, it's unfamiliar, it's unknown, and therefore scary.
At least that.
Yeah.
At least that. I think that's exactly right. If you didn't hear the comment, he said freedom's hard because it's unchartered, it's unknown, and it's scary, that for sure. Yeah, the hold in prayer. When I first saw it and said that, I kind of resented that it was sort of co-opted by holding. That's universal prayer of the church. You know, it comes out of evening prayer. I pray that every day. No, we're still on the journey.
I think of free as being, you know, easy and kind of a snap. And it's positive and flow. I guess you're right.
Yeah, but I think, see, I would say struggle is positive. Struggle, that's one of the problems. We've interpreted struggle as negative. But struggle isn't negative. Struggle is positive. Especially when the alternative is bondage. It's kind of like, it's like the word of Jesus, you know, enter through the narrow gate. Okay. Say, boy, that's a hard word. Well, it depends on who's talking to who about what. You know, I mean, if you're struggling to get in someplace and you can't figure out any way to get in, and somebody comes along and says, look, you can go in through the narrow gate. Well, okay, the gate's narrow. But Jesus, at least it's better than no way in at all, you know.
The point about in slavery to too much, and that too much is not freedom, I think is well taken also. I think that you can see that in American life easily if you have attained the riches, you have a vacation home or more than one vehicle, or you buy a boat or whatever, you find that your time is consumed with concern whether somebody is watching the vacation home when you're not there, the fiberglass is okay on the boat or whatever, and soon the possessions own you, and that is no real freedom. I think we see then the illustration of eating yourself to death very frequently in American life.
If anybody upstairs, by the way, there wants to say something, I've got this pipe in front of me, so you need to just interrupt and butt in. I'm not consciously ignoring anybody.
I've always liked the thought that a lot of people don't want to, they say they don't want to go to church, they don't want to be a Christian and so on, because it restricts them. You know, you have to just do this and do that and do it. But I think in Christianity we're freer than those people are.
Freedom is one of those relational words. I mean, it doesn't mean a whole lot just saying it by itself. And it needs some interpretation. I remember a kind of old illustration from a preacher way back. You know, he said, you take a violin string and you lay it down on the table. It's not attached to anything. Is the violin string free? It can't do what a violin string is supposed to do in that condition. It's got to be tied down on both ends and stretched pretty tight before it can be free to be a violin string. You know, so I mean, freedom is one of those relational words. And so in a large sense, you know, our concept of freedom is going to be fleshed out by our basic concept of what it means to be human.